The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am honored to welcome our guest this afternoon. Our guest today burst onto the national political stage as the keynote speaker at the 2012 Democratic National Convention. But as I expect you know, these things don't happen overnight. Like most of our stories, our guests begin several generations back with an ancestor who made the journey to our country's promising shores. In Julian Castro's case, the ancestor was his six-year-old orphan grandmother. It's a story that continued with his activist mother and father who helped guide him and his twin brother Joaquin to Stanford and then Harvard Law School. From there, Julian returned to his native San Antonio, which he helped transform into one of the country's leading economies. The journey continued with an invitation from President Obama to become the 16th U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, a post that was held by Henry Cisneros, who was here just a few weeks ago. In his new book, An Unlikely Journey, Waking Up from My American Dream, Castro echoes the aspirational spirit of Obama's dreams from my father, affirming just what it means to be an American during an era of political cynicism and cultural divisiveness. He'll be in conversation today with longtime journalist and award-winning broadcaster Tracy Matisak. Please welcome Julian Castro and Tracy Matisak to the Free Library.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Delighted to see so many of you here at midday to welcome Secretary Castro to Philadelphia. As you know, if you've been here before, he and I will chat for 30 minutes or maybe a little longer, but we would encourage you to take some notes because we've budgeted some time for your questions as well. So we will welcome those at the end of our conversation. So, Mr. Secretary, welcome.
Thanks a lot. Can y'all hear me? All right, good, good.
So the book is called An Unlikely Journey. The subtitle is Waking Up from My American Dream. What does that mean, waking up from my American dream?
Yeah, and first of all, thanks a lot. And thank you to everybody for being here. The subtitle is Waking Up from My American Dream. And what I mean by that is that in thinking through my family's history in the United States, you know, I tell the story of my grandmother coming over as a little girl who had lost her parents, and ending up on the west side of San Antonio. She came at a time when you could still see these storefront posters that said, no Negroes, no Mexicans or dogs allowed. And you know, she never got a real education because they pulled her out of elementary school. She raised my mother as a single parent. My mom was a child of the 60s and rebelled. And was very political. She became a civil rights activist in the old Chicano movement of the late 1960s and early 1970s. And then Joaquin and I, of course, have gone into public service. And the subtitle refers to kind of our realization in each generation that, you know, it's not enough to just work hard or for your family to work hard, but that, you know, you have to work hard in some way to improve community and where we are as a nation in order to expand opportunity. My brother and I have been able to avail ourselves of so much more opportunity than my grandmother could have imagined, or even my mom. And I think about that subtitle with resonance for the young people today who see leadership that I think is trying to take us backward. And if we all want to be able to reach that American dream and to keep it alive, it's incumbent upon everybody to keep pushing us forward in the right direction. Yeah.
Well, speaking of opportunity and leadership, you have said that you are strongly considering a run for president, correct?
Yeah. Did I say
what
that?
More can you, that's what we're hearing.
Yeah, I said
can you tell us more?
That I've been seriously considering running for president in 2020, and I'm likely to do that. but that I'm going to make a decision after the November election. And there are kind of two things that I still need to do. One is to have the kind of long, real conversation with my wife, Erica, and my family that you have to have before you make that kind of decision. Of course, she and I have talked about it, but we haven't had that conversation yet. And then secondly, I've been traveling the country supporting candidates that are on the ballot right now, because the most important thing is the 15 days that we have left until these midterms. And so I've been supporting candidates throughout the country, and including, of course, in my home state of Texas, where I believe that Ted Cruz is going to lose and Beto O'Rourke is going to become the next senator. But I do want to see what happens in the midterm, because I'm convinced that these elections do set a mood and they send a message from the American people. And you know, I'm not in a absolute rush to make a final decision. And so I want to see what the American people are saying on November 6th.
So one of the concerns is that, particularly in the Latino community, that there is not a lot of enthusiasm about getting to the polls. And maybe that's just in Texas, I don't know. But what are your concerns about that? And what needs to be done to make sure that people of whatever ethnicity are energized to get to the polls?
Gosh, a lot of things. And I think there are different reasons for that. One reason is that, especially in a state like Texas, the leadership has done everything that they can to create an inertia against people going to vote, especially lower income folks, and that has sort of ensnared a lot of the Hispanic community down there. Another is that I think these days especially, there's a decent amount of fear in a lot of families, even families, most of which or all of which, if they're Latino, are here as citizens or here legally. You know, just a reluctance to interact with the government in some quarters. And then I do think in the Latino community, you got to admit, you know, just consistently, the rate of voting has not been there. And that's going to take a massive and sustained effort by folks that invest in voter registration and turnout to do that. It can't be one or two or a few candidates that do it. It can't just be in the 6 months before an election. It has to be a sustained effort to encourage registration and turnout. And it also takes great candidates that are speaking to the issues that people are motivated by. I think there's been this assumption that because of how bad Trump has been on immigration, that would propel Latinos to the polls. And I do think that what that's done is that it's woken a lot of people up that weren't paying attention before. But there also has to be a strong agenda on healthcare, on education, on infrastructure, on all the things that strike at the very heart of people that are oftentimes struggling to make it in this country. And then just finally, I think that, you know, the Latino community is an aspirational community, like a lot of folks. And the politics of today are so nasty. I haven't heard as many people tell me before as have told me in the last year, for instance, that they don't watch cable TV anymore. They don't watch cable news because they're just throwing up their hands, like, I don't want to hear it anymore. And so, ironically, the folks that are engineering this negativism and division end up winning in some ways because people kind of check out, right? I think to some extent that's part of the dynamic today.
You mentioned immigration, and just in the last several days we've seen this so-called caravan, 7,000 strong, of people from Central America who are moving toward the border. President Trump said over the weekend they might as well turn back because they're not coming in here. This morning he tweeted, among other things, that there are some unknown Middle Easterners in that group and we're going to pull funding from those countries, Honduras, et cetera, that these people represent. I'm curious to hear your view about what do we do and how should we as a nation handle a situation like this?
Yeah, well, you know, we have procedures in place to deal with individuals that present themselves at the border. And if they have a legitimate asylum claim, then I believe that those should be heard. Obviously, we need a strong partner in Mexico as well. And I think that this really highlights two things. Number one, that Trump has been a failure when it comes to immigration policy. Because basically he told us that if we tortured families by taking away the little children from the parents, that would deter more families from coming, right? I mean, basically that's what they were saying. That was basically the rationale for what has been a very cruel, really un-American or inhumane policy. And as far as I'm concerned, has been state-sponsored child abuse of these kids because of the trauma that they're gonna go through for a long time. And then you didn't even get the result because more families are coming. So you failed. And then secondly, it highlights that we have an opportunity in this 21st century to forge much stronger relationships with Latin America to help make sure that we don't have to face this issue in the first place. Think about what the United States did after World War II and how we forged the coalition of nations, of NATO and other organizations with Europe, which has been tremendous to keep the peace, oftentimes to avert war, although, of course, that didn't always happen. But the world has been better because of that alliance. But we haven't done that kind of thing in our own backyard. We need to be smarter about forging these alliances to prevent that kind of caravan from happening in the first place, because the countries can be safer and people can have opportunity there and not feel like they have to risk everything because they want to provide for their children. I hope more than anything else that people of different backgrounds see now with these folks that are trying to come over. I mean, why would you do that? You're not doing that for no reason. You're doing it because you're desperate, right? And what we need to do is address in a smart way the desperation and help as we can in a smart way improve the situation in those countries.
You were part of President Obama's cabinet. You were the HUD secretary during those years. And
I wish we had him back, frankly.
And you know, as much criticism as President Trump gets for his immigration policy, as quiet as it's kept, President Obama was criticized as well. In fact, Jorge Ramos was here some months ago, and we talked about that. He has called President Obama the deporter in chief. How might you, as a future president, handle things differently?
Well, I think that we need to find ways, and I believe the Obama administration got better and better along the way on the issue of immigration. In the book, I talk about in 2014 making some comments that were critical of the administration at that time surrounding the issue of parents, of dreamers, and so forth. But, you know, the administration also put forward DACA, and then it put forward DAPA. DAPA never came into being because of the courts. But I do think that it got better. In the future, we need to take a page from something that they tried toward the end, for instance, which was to use leg monitors to allow families to not be in cages and to be with their children, and yet have accountability so that they would check in the legal process. That initiative, that program, was actually very successful in terms of people actually abiding by the rules and coming back and being part of the legal process. By this, I mean undocumented immigrants who had come into the country and they need to go through the legal process. The question is, you know, where do you put them? Do you house them somewhere? Do you, as Trump is trying to do, try to change the Flores holding, essentially to be able to keep families and children together, but to do it in these detention centers, I think we need to move to a system where we have accountability for the people, but it's more humane than we have right now. We can accomplish both of those things and still have strong border protection and enforcement in our country.
I want to circle back to presidential politics for a moment. One of the criticisms of the Democratic Party since 2016 is that there's not a clear message. Number one, there's not a clear leader, and secondly, there's not a clear message. Do the Democrats yet have a message for 2020? And if so, what is it, or what should it be?
Well, I think we have to start with 2018, and the message is, if you believe in an America where everybody counts, and that we're going to have opportunity for everybody. You believe in the Democratic Party. If you believe in accountability in government and that absolute power corrupts absolutely, as we've seen over the last 18 months, then you should vote Democrat. Mm-hmm. It's about opportunity and it's about accountability, I think, in 2018 and then going forward. I also believe, and I've said, that you're not going to beat Donald Trump by trying to be Donald Trump, right? I think you're going to defeat Donald Trump by putting forward a strong, positive vision for the future. And you have to be able to call him out and stand up to him, but we've seen very clearly that the Democrats who succeed are those who represent a new generation of leadership with a strong, positive vision for the future. Think about the new frontier of John Kennedy, or what Jimmy Carter represented in 1976 after we'd gone through the scandal of Watergate, what Bill Clinton represented in 1992, or especially what Barack Obama represented in 2008, this idea of the United States coming together and no red states and blue states and a hope that we could all prosper together. History teaches us that those are the kinds of folks who inspire. And I think that that's the key for 2020, too. I also don't see, I've gotten asked this question a lot. You know, they said, oh, well, you're thinking about running for president. Oh, what are you going to do? Donald Trump is so abrasive, and he's a street fighter. And I don't know why people are so scared of Donald Trump. I mean, he lost by 2.8 million votes. In 2016, he was untested, unproven. He was potential energy that people could dream about. He's not that anymore. He has a record. And so I think that you're going to have a different election in 2020 than you had in 2016.
I want to talk about some current events. The conversation about Russian interference in the 2016 election is ongoing. Dan Coats, the director of National Intelligence, said the lights are flashing red, that they are still at it and will likely continue to do this unless we take some drastic action. What are your concerns around that, especially as a prospective candidate who could be affected by that?
What was the question?
So your concerns about continuing Russian meddling in electoral system in the United States.
That we need a national standard for election security in this country. We don't have that. We need Congress and the executive branch to take that seriously along with each of the state elections secretaries. Until we have that, I don't think that we can ever be fully confident in the integrity of our process. The other thing is, you know, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or other social media companies, holding them to account for improving their security. We've seen some of that, but I think that we can do a lot more.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the book, An Unlikely Journey. You write about your childhood, you and your brother and your mom and your grandmother, and what a profound influence your mom and your grandmother in particular played on your life. And there is a theme throughout the book about the importance of education and the life-changing difference that it can make. I'd love for you to read a little passage for us that has to do with that, about a very important day in the life of you and your brother, Joaquin. Have it marked there if you wouldn't mind reading that, and then we'll talk about it.
All right, so this is from 1992. By March, fat packets began hitting the mailbox. Princeton and the University of Pennsylvania accepted me, while Harvard rejected me and Notre Dame waitlisted me. Joaquin and I were both accepted at a number of other schools. The University of California at Berkeley was the first school that took us both. As we waited for other replies, we felt a sense of victory. And we knew we were California bound, but we hadn't yet heard from our real goal, Stanford. I've been known to miss a birthday or two, but Friday, April 3rd, 1992 is a date I'll never forget. Two identical 8.5 by 11 inch white envelopes with green borders sat in our mailbox. As most college applicants know, thick packets are a thumbs up, while thin ones are usually a thumbs down. Like some sort of ritual, Joaquin and I walked in holding our unopened envelopes and called out to Mom and Mama, which is my grandmother. Then we ripped them open. Quote, "Welcome to the Stanford class of 1996, the letter began. As Joaquin and I took turns reading the acceptance letter, it began to sink in what that moment meant to the multiple generations sitting there in that small kitchen. Mommel, orphaned and yanked out of school by the third grade. Mom, struggling and sacrificing to teach and support us so that we could have opportunities exactly like this. These two envelopes were a collective victory, a family achievement. I wish I'd had a cell phone camera to capture Mommel's face in that moment. She'd been deprived of a formal education and the advantages that come with it. She never could have imagined that such an opportunity would be possible.
Thank you. Thank you. And Mommel, if I remember right, passed away just before graduation from Stanford?
That's right. My grandmother had diabetes, and she was basically bedridden for the last few months of her life and ended up passing away in mid-February of 1996, just a few months before Joaquin and I graduated from Stanford. And one of the last things that I got to show her was that I had gotten into Harvard Law School. And so I was very happy that at least she knew that even kind of the next few years of my life were going to be good.
Yeah. In speaking about education and what a priority that is for you, and thinking about your own journey, how would you help young people today who, like you, aspire to a college education and yet tuition is spiraling out of control? What would you do to help other young people like you to receive a quality college education?
Well, I think that in this 21st century global economy, where you're competing against these countries that are producing young people that are super talented, intelligent, creative, ready to take on the world, coming up with innovative ideas and products and companies, I'm convinced that what that means is that, number one, we don't have anybody to waste in the United States, that we need everybody's talent. Secondly, it's very clear that today requires more skill, more brain power than ever before. So I see at least the first 2 years of college as being equivalent to what high school used to be, right? There was a time when we didn't require as much education as we do now. In some states, they still don't even require kindergarten formally, but most people take that. Right? Today requires more education than before. So whether it's a BA or an associate's degree or at least some sort of certification that people can get so that they can get gainful employment, I believe that we ought to find a way to make that essentially free for people so that they don't have $100,000 worth of loans when they get out of school. And the good news is that, number one, this is what we used to be able to do in the past. How many folks from my parents' generation or grandparents' generation, you hear people say, oh, that the state university costs $50 a credit hour, right? Remember? Those days were long gone now, right? And then secondly, today, certain states and certain communities, cities, actually subsidize the ability of folks to go and get a community college education. So it's not so far off and impossible for this nation to do. We can find a way to pay for it because we used to do it and because there are some states that are already doing it.
Yeah. Any thoughts on how we might go about that?
Well, I mean, number one, I think that we have to undo these terrible tax cuts that the Trump administration has enacted. But more than that, we need the help of the states as well and their systems and finding ways, I think, to be able to prioritize public education, a university or community college education, more than we have before.
I want to talk about Joaquin a little bit, your brother, who is a congressman representing Texas, and you write extensively, of course, about him in the book and how hyper-competitive the two of you were growing up and how over the years that's mellowed out to some degree. But I'm curious to know about whether there is a political calculus that the two of you have to engage in, because you're both in public service, he's a congressman, he has been encouraged to run for governor, you may run for president, and is there a sort of delicate balance or a calculus that the two of you have to do in terms of who runs for what and how my decision might steal thunder from you or impact your aspirations in politics?
Yeah, to some extent, but less so than you would think. But let me address the some extent. Number one, people often think of us as the same person. Right? My brother made some comments the other day that he clarified regarding whether Jared Kushner had been, communicating with the Saudis. And you know, he clarified his comments, but I can't tell you how many folks on Twitter are saying, oh, what did Julian Castro say about what? I mean, you know, a lot of folks don't know the difference between my brother and me. That will be solved, right, if I decide to run. But that does, as a practical matter, sure, that impacts, right? I need to make sure, I'm always aware of what I'm saying and doing and how that might impact him, and I think the same thing for me on his end. But the neat thing is that today, unlike when we were young and we were so competitive, we basically support each other and collaborate with each other. And that's been a neat thing to watch in our relationship. It's kind of like how your relationship with your parents is different when you're 35 versus when you're 15, right? It just matures. Our relationship has matured. And so if I decide to run in 2020, I'm sure that he will be my biggest supporter and advisor. The first time that I ran for office in 2001 for city council, I want to say he was my treasurer. And he was the one that knocked on the most doors and made the most phone calls for me. And we have always been super supportive. And then I did that for him when he ran a year later for state representative. So I think there's much more positive in there than negative.
Yeah. Want to talk about a couple of other things before we turn it over to the audience. You mentioned just a moment ago the Saudis and Jared Kushner, which reminds me to ask you what you make of the Jamal Khashoggi situation and the United States' response to it thus far.
Well, the United States' response to it has been very troubling because this country is supposed to be the country that stands up for a free press and for truth. And not only in this episode, but so much over the last 18 months, we have completely abandoned our moral leadership in the world. I mean, basically, Angela Merkel had to come out with a stronger statement and tell the Saudis, we need to get to the bottom of what happened here. Donald Trump, several days later, is still kind of equivocating about what might have happened or not, what may have happened or didn't happen. It's just so disappointing to watch because it's like being in the pole position amongst countries in the world where nations around the world are looking to you for economic leadership, for moral leadership, and you're just giving both of those things away. Little by little, you're giving that up. And the thing is, we're not going to recognize that in the span of 1 year or maybe even 10 years. But this country will be much worse off if we continue down this path in the years to come. And the people that pay the price the most for that will be your grandchildren, your children. And that's why whoever gets elected president next, and whether it's in 2020 or 2024, although I hope not, they desperately need to get the country back on the track of being a moral leader and being an economic leader as well.
Yeah. So assuming that person is you in 2020 or 2024, what would you do to change the way the United States is viewed as a result of the 2016 election and following?
Well, I think it starts with reaffirming our commitment to work with our allies, whether it's NATO or other allies, and also not being afraid, as in this case with Saudi Arabia, to hold our allies accountable, right? We can't be afraid to hold our allies accountable when they need to be held accountable, because that strengthens the relationship over time. And I think doing that also signals that the United States stands for certain principles. As I said, I would also look for new ways to expand our alliances around the world, especially in our own backyard in Latin America, because I think there's a lot of ways that we can be stronger there, and especially because you have nations like China that are going around the world, whether in Africa or in Latin America, and forging their own alliances, right? Both economically and then in the future, potentially militarily. And the United States needs to be smarter about how we're laying the groundwork for that, because right now we're basically giving it up to China. And again, that may not hurt us in a year, may not hurt us in a decade, but that's going to hurt us in the long run. And so everybody who cares about the future strength of this country ought to care about us playing a longer and smarter game than we are now.
Yeah. One of the big concerns has been climate change and our withdrawal from the Paris Climate Agreement. And now there has been this very dire report that has come out from the UN panel on climate change saying that if we don't do something as a planet, something drastic and soon, by 2040, we're in a world of trouble in terms of increased food shortages and wildfires and so forth. How might you address that, and what needs to be done to begin to reverse the damage?
Well, the first thing is that we should not pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement. I've been very proud of the local communities, especially the mayors, for instance, and some governors that have stepped up and said, no, we're going to live up to the goals that we set. It's also significant that I believe the date where we could formally actually pull out of that is something like the date after the election in 2020. Well, when Donald Trump loses, that ain't going to happen. You know, it's not going to happen. So number one, to stay in it and to work even harder than we've been working in this administration to not only meet those goals, which I believe we can still do, but also to surpass them. And to continue to educate folks here and abroad that we don't have to choose between being economically strong and being responsible with our planet. In fact, when we do both, when we are responsible with our planet, we're going to be economically stronger. So I would continue, as I did as mayor of San Antonio, to push us into embracing renewable energy, for us to get smarter about the use of our resources than we have been under this administration, which again seems like it's just bent on taking us backward.
Well, I always save my toughest question for last, so I hope you're ready for this. You write in the book, in talking about the competitiveness between yourself and your brother, that you even supported competing football teams. Yes. He was a Cowboys fan, and you were a Philadelphia Eagles fan.
Right. Yeah. That's
so,
not a very tough question in the middle of Philadelphia. If I go to Dallas, you know, that might be different.
That's a tough question in Dallas. But here's the thing. Yesterday's heartbreak notwithstanding, are you still on the bandwagon with the Philadelphia Eagles?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I've been a fan of the Eagles since Wilbur Montgomery and Ron Jaworski. And then my favorite player that I mentioned in the book was Randall Cunningham. I say in the book that my dream was to be like Randall Cunningham, except win a Super Bowl. So, my brother took the Dallas Cowboys early, and he and my mother liked them. So since we were so competitive, I had to get a different team. And I don't know why, I just took the Eagles, I guess because they were in the NFC East, and I would see them play. And on the days when the Eagles would play the Cowboys at home, you did not want to be in our house. Like, I think a few times we got into fights, I pushed him against the wall, and it left an indentation in the wall for years. We were ridiculously passionate about it back then. And during that time of the 80s and 90s, I had to watch as the Cowboys won Super Bowls. And you know, usually they would win during that time. So y'all can imagine, as being here in Philadelphia, how happy I was last year. Of course, it kind of felt, you know, like it was late because we're not as into it as we were back. It would have been wonderful if they had been able to win, except for that damn Fog Bowl against Chicago, in 88 or whenever it was.
We're just glad that they won at all, because we all waited a long time for that, and we're glad that you're still on the bandwagon. So on that happy note, let's take questions from our audience. We've got some staff members with microphones, so yes, just raise your hand and we'll get a microphone to you.
Do you think that the current immigration statutes and regulations are adequate if they're fairly and appropriately enforced, or do you think we need legislative immigration reform?
My hope is that we're going to get some sort of comprehensive immigration reform that deals effectively with, of course, continued border security and enforcement through the smart use of both personnel, of people, and technology to keep our border as safe as possible. And that we're also going to humanely address the 10 to 11 million people who are here who are undocumented. My hope is that we're going to find a way so that as long as people have not committed serious crimes and they're earnestly working toward, you know, being productive, good members of this society, that we find a path to citizenship for them, of earned citizenship. So in that sense, I'd say that right now that our laws are not in the best interest of everybody in the country. And I hope that we can take another crack at it in the next few years. As you know, we almost got there in 2013. There were 68 senators, very bipartisan, that voted for comprehensive immigration reform. A lot of people are convinced that it would have passed in the House if John Boehner had allowed it to be taken to a vote. Of course, he didn't. You remember that that happened because the American people sent a strong message in November of 2012 on that issue and others when they reelected Barack Obama. I hope that in 18 and in 20, they send that message again, and that by 2021, we can perhaps be in the position to get comprehensive immigration reform done.
I have so many questions, but I'll start with this one, and hopefully my other question will get asked. Why politics? What made two competitive San Antonio kids decide that this is where they both wanted to go?
Yeah, well, I think part of it had to do with growing up with a mom that that had gotten so active. And she ran for city council when she was 23 years old in 71, and she lost. There were very few women and very few people of color elected at that time. We had no single-member districts in San Antonio. But and then she stepped away a little bit from that after she had us, and she was raising us, you know, as a single mom. But she was still active, volunteering on campaigns and working on different women's empowerment issues and Hispanic issues. So we grew up going to rallies and speeches and different organizational meetings. And we were kind of around it. If you had asked me at 15, did I think that I would go into politics, I would have said no, because I didn't see what good it did for people. You know, like I didn't connect it to actually changing people's lives. Both because I saw in the neighborhoods that I was growing up in a lot of challenges, and because my mom had come from an outsider, right? I didn't see the value of getting into it until I went away from San Antonio. And I could compare the community that I had grown up in with the Bay Area. And I saw in the Bay Area this place that had higher income levels, higher education levels. This was at the beginning of the 90s, and it was more entrepreneurial and more ready for the future. And in terms of my hometown, I saw a place that was special because I like to say that, you know, if two people passed each other on the sidewalk downtown, that they would still look each other in the eye. Or if somebody sneezes in a restaurant, you know, that two or three people still say, bless you. In other words, that there was still sense of connection among folks, like this sense of community that often eludes places as they get bigger and bigger and people kind of wall themselves off or get more guarded, scared of each other. That hadn't happened yet. And my interest in going into politics was that I had a chip on my shoulder about that city, that I wanted more people from there to be able to have the kind of opportunity that my brother and I had. And I was excited by the prospect of going back and combining what I had seen in the Bay Area and then in Boston in terms of improving its entrepreneurialism and improving educational prospects and trying to create more good job opportunities, but then also keeping what I felt was very special about the community. And that was essentially, you know, my platform when I ran for city council and then ran for mayor. And that's originally why I got into politics.
Yes, I'm a bit uncomfortable with your reasoning as to why the Latino vote is so reluctant to get to the polls. And Republican Party is very good at marketing, and we are not. The Republican Party is good at lying and being nasty. And we don't have to lie and be nasty, but we should be more aggressive. So why don't you put the fear of not voting into the Latino community instead of dwelling on their fears as to why they don't vote?
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, first of all, I think that some of that is being done, you know, on Spanish language TV especially. There's both the positive and the negative messages that are out there. There are negative messages about, you know, the potential consequences of another couple of years of this Republican Congress and of Donald Trump. And so that's there. Now, let me delve into that a little bit more. I have not actually seen the research on what moves people more, right? I don't know, does it move people more to scare them like that and actually producing turnout or to appeal to their aspirations? But I have a feeling that in the long run, at least, it's probably appealing to their aspirations. And if it were enough to scare them, I think they're scared now. Right? And if that's not producing turnout, then we need to look for a different approach, a different way to do it. I forgot to mention in my answer to that question that I was encouraged. Y'all may have seen that yesterday the NBC Wall Street Journal poll came out. And the big headline from it, of course, was that among likely voters that in the generic ballot, Democrats were ahead 50-41, which still is a significant advantage. But one of the crosstabs had the enthusiasm level of different groups. And I think the enthusiasm level for Democrats overall was 72%, and for Latinos it was 71%. They were within the top three of different subgroups in terms of enthusiasm, which was different, an outlier from what we've seen in other polling, but hopeful, right, that it did find that. So, you know, we'll have to see on November 6th. Maybe it is the case that, you know, we're misreading it and that turnout is going to be there. I'm not sure yet. But I take your point. I very much take your point. And I do think that there's a place for leveling with people about the consequences of what's going to happen. Like, I completely agree with you. I think you've got to do that in the right measure and then also inspire in the right measure. And you can't be afraid to be aggressive, right? You also have to be mindful to be inspirational, too. And it really, it's people that can pull off both of those well that you want to look for without getting into the worst of what we've seen in this administration of just lying and trying to distort the truth. And because if we ever lose that, if we all become that, you know, this country will not exist as we know it for much longer if we all let go of the truth.
Hey, sir, how's it going? Zach Dunn from UTSA.
It's, hey, Zach. It's
been a while since I've seen you.
Zach was at UTSA when I was mayor.
Yeah. San Antonio, best city in the country, right next to Philadelphia. You were very capable of staying above the fray of some of the dirty politics that comes with being a city councilman and being a mayor, and you did it for years. And I just want to know maybe how you plan to use the lessons that you gained early in your political career to stay above that fray still and be a president that this whole country can unite behind.
Yeah, and you know, thanks for the question. In the book, I talked about my early experience in city council, and I had gone back after graduating from law school, and I got elected about a year after I got home. So this was May of 2001, and I took a job at a law firm at Akin Gump, which at the time had the largest office in San Antonio, and they had a client that wanted to develop this golf course over the Edwards Aquifer Recharge Zone, which basically we're the largest city in San Antonio that relies on an underground aquifer for our drinking water. And there was a lot of concern that that development might pollute the aquifer, so it would ultimately impact the quality of the drinking water. And I wanted to vote against that project. But I couldn't vote against it because it was a client of the law firm. And you can't go against the interests of a, you know, a client as an attorney. And then there were a couple of other like this was a big issue in San Antonio at the time. There were a couple of lower profile issues where I also was conflicted out. And so one day in January of 2002, I just walked in and I quit my job. And I talk in the book about how I had obviously had a big advantage because I had a degree from Harvard Law School and I could find gainful employment, but I struggled a little bit and my home almost went into foreclosure. Eventually, my brother and I had our own law firm. But for me, that was an initial test, a very important test of whether I would stick to what I believed. Because before I went into politics, the number one worry that I had was whether you would have to sell yourself out to succeed at this. Whether you would emerge on the other side of it as a different person that you wouldn't have liked when you went in. And I could have just kept taking the money and told my constituents, oh, well, I can't vote on this because of the law firm. And I think I made the right decision. And to connect that to your actual question, if I run, what I plan to do is to speak to the sensibilities of people that just want honest, good government, in addition to, wanting investments that will help create jobs and prevent climate change and so forth. I think what people are looking for is that they want folks that are committed to serving them instead of serving themselves and serving other politicians, whether that's getting redistricting out of the hands of the politicians and into the hands of the people, or figuring out ways that we can encourage people to work together in public office instead of always being divided into camps. I enjoyed the fact that I had to work in a nonpartisan system in San Antonio. We had nonpartisan elections. Obviously, I'm a proud Democrat, but when we were block walking, we would go up to everybody's door, whether you were Republican or Democrat, and knock on the door and talk to people about creating jobs and police protection and the streets and code compliance. That was very educational for me, and it's part of that spirit that I think if I run that I'll take with me and trying to bridge some of the divide that exists in our country right now. And I'm not Pollyannish about it. I know that a lot of times people are in their tribes, but I do think folks are looking for people that are going to make the attempt in the right way.
Since we may not be able to solve the immigration problem fast, is there any way we could work with Mexico to make them a better alternative and solve the problems that they have, that we, people don't want to go there?
Yeah, I believe that has to be a strong component of our approach, because folks that are coming from Guatemala or other countries often go through Mexico first. And so we have every interest in working with Mexico to ensure that they address those issues of migration as effectively as possible. That means for some people being granted asylum if they have a legitimate case under Mexico's approach. It also means how can we ensure, in a way that is mutually beneficial to the United States, of course, first and foremost, that Mexico has opportunity and folks want to stay there in Mexico instead of trying to come over to the United States, right? If they're doing well, first of all, I don't believe that for us to do well, they have to do badly, right? But if they're doing better as a country, that probably means that more people are able to get jobs and opportunity there and stay there in Mexico instead of coming over here. If they're addressing effectively the issues of people coming from Guatemala and other countries that first have to go through their borders, that means we're going to have to deal less with that here when they would present themselves at our southern border. And so that was my point about being more aggressive and more collaborative with Mexico and Latin America than we have before. Folks will know that we have a long and sometimes checkered history of involvement in a whole bunch of those countries down there. And there are resentments against the United States, right? And now is a better time than ever to start working through those relationships and seeing how we can create victories on both sides. And I just don't see any leadership there. And, and I wouldn't say that's only the case. I think it's worse now, but I wouldn't say that's only the case now. I don't think that we've ever lived up to our potential with Mexico and Latin America. And that if we want to be a stronger nation going forward, in a nation, in a world where we're competing against China and India and other countries that are making big moves, then we ought to take advantage of the opportunity that we could have down there.
It's Carolyn Richmond from Micro Society. I'm asking two questions. We're making one comment and another question. When we were working in San Antonio, we began to hear about the strategic planning process that you were going through in San Antonio. And I just wanted to make a plug that I hope if you do become president, you might encourage other cities to go through that same process. It was really fascinating to witness and a very healthy strategy, I think, for rejuvenating and positioning a city to be prepared for the year 2020. So just wanted to make that comment. The second comment I wanted to ask was, what do you think, in the United States we talk about our being so behind in education, and we hear often that the United States is behind Shanghai and Finland and other countries, and when we're talking about that, people do not understand that we're referring to an international PISA test. And that test is quite different than the test our children take in the United States. One is about very complex real-world problems, whereas one is about filling in the blanks, filling in the dots in sort of a right and wrong answer. So I'm wondering, as president, what you might do to sort of change that awareness and perhaps change the way in which we hold our children accountable in that more global context.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, let me begin by saying that I don't believe that we should have folks out there teaching to a test, and that too often our classrooms have become really about teaching to the test and limiting students' thinking instead of encouraging critical thinking. We need to encourage critical thinking in this country, all right? And obviously, you're talking about the distinction and the measurement of those tests. You know, I believe if we move in the direction of encouraging critical thinking and also of making sure that we don't let things like the arts and music go by the wayside in our country, because that helps with critical thinking and creativity. You know, Texas is a great example of this. I mean, Texas used to be, I think, better. And then it started going down this cascade of different standardized tests. My wife was a classroom teacher for, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, and for the last few years, she's been a math specialist, like a coordinator of elementary math teachers. My father was a math teacher for 31 years, mostly high school. And, you know, talking to them, I've seen how it changed over time. We need to go back to what helped create a society of more critical thinkers. And also, obviously, fund public education better than we do now. Pay teachers what they deserve to be paid. And during the Obama administration, with Race to the Top, there was an attempt basically to incentivize communities to adopt best practices that were crafted at the local level, right? That got very, very politicized. Y'all remember, right? But I think that is still a promising approach to work with local communities and states to design ways that they can encourage more critical thinking and the kind of achievement that will lead, I think, to students that are able to more effectively have opportunities in the future. The last thing I'll say is to your bringing up SA 2020. SA 2020 was this visioning process that we did in San Antonio that we kicked off on Saturday, September 25th, 2010. And the question was, what kind of city do we want to be on Friday, September 25th, 2020? And so over the course of about 6 or 7 months, thousands of San Antonians engaged in this process with us at several community gatherings, large gatherings that focused on setting specific numeric goals for the community. You know, how many units of housing did we want to get built in the urban core of the city? You know, how much did we want to improve the drive time? How much did we want to decrease the amount of gallons per person that were used in terms of water so that we could be better about conservation? As many folks probably know, down in the Southwest, this is a very serious issue with water. So across the board, I'm proud of that effort. And I do think it was a nice blueprint, and that some other communities have taken from that and adapted it to their own community. It has given me the occasion to think about how you would do something at a national level that seeks to engage the American people in envisioning the future of this country together. I mean, when was the last time that you saw a president actually go out to a community, let's say it's, I don't know, Atlanta or Philadelphia or, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, wherever, and convene the community and listen and engage them in actually forging a blueprint for the country in the future? The problem with the federal level is that you're just part of this ecosystem of divisive partisan politics, and so many players that often get in the way of the American people getting directly engaged to do that. But I do believe that if the president uses the bully pulpit effectively, that you could approximate that and get more than just Democrats to participate in that, because that would be the key. It would have to be something far beyond just the people in your own party. And there are forces that would try and stop that, right? That don't want that kind of bringing together of people, because that's not in their interest at the ballot box. But I think if you were determined to do it, that you could approximate something like that a little bit differently, adapted for the national level. And I would love to do that. I would love to go and be a part of something like that, whether I were the president or not.
Yeah. Two questions. One, nobody has ever thought of engaging Canada, which is an underpopulated country, for these immigrants. They're obviously willing to live anywhere but where they're coming from and do any amount of work just not to have their kids pulled into gangs. So one, if you were president, would you consider that? And two, while running for president, I don't believe it's possible to get out of the way of Trump's insults. What would you do to avoid getting pulled into the gutter? How do you do it?
Yeah. I guess your first question, yeah, of course, Canada has its own approach on immigration. And so,
don't take anyone for certain.
Yes. You know, I think that what we want for folks, right, is number one, the United States ought to stand for treating people humanely. If they present ourselves at the border, then we have a legal process to address that. I think what this administration has done is it tried to, you know, cleverly try and throw a wrench in some of that. I mean, we're big enough. We should not be afraid of these folks who are presenting themselves. We're big enough as a nation to handle that. And if there are people that, you know, some of them that are granted asylum, okay. I imagine, you know, that you're going to have a whole bunch of them that are not, okay, but there's a process there. And in terms of working with other nations, of course, I think it always makes sense to work with other nations, whether it's Canada or maybe most especially Mexico, because they're coming through Mexico, so that we know that they're there. And we need to ensure that Mexico is being a strong partner in dealing, you know, with this issue. In terms of your second question, yeah, there are different ways to deal with that. I don't think that you need to get caught up in the back and forth. And one of the most fascinating races this cycle to watch for me, both with respect to the trajectory of his candidacy and also how he's dealt with Trump, has been Andrew Gillum in Florida. If you notice, I mean, he started off in fourth or fifth place in a primary that had, I think, like 2 or 3 billionaires, and then the rest were very wealthy folks. He came up from fourth place and won very convincingly on election day. And I was there. I endorsed him in May of 2017, and then I went out. And the last weekend before the primary in August, I was with him on a little bus tour. And to see the enthusiasm, I mean, it was just fantastic to see the trajectory of his candidacy. But with regard to Trump, you know, he hasn't been afraid to go back at Trump, right, to push back when Trump tweets something, but he also has not engaged in the nicknames and the, yeah, and so there's that model. The other one that I found fascinating, even though we never saw a general election contest, was Bernie. If you notice what Bernie did, Bernie pretty much like ignored a lot of Trump and stuck to his issues, right, that were speaking to people, right? And I did think that, although again, we never got to see what would happen if they had been in a general election, but I found, even obviously as somebody that supported Hillary, that Bernie had a fairly effective way of dealing with that. Let me just finish that by reminding folks that Hillary Clinton beat this guy by 2.8 million votes. And she also, like, she held her own, right? Of course, I think anybody would say in that campaign that, you know, next time we need to make sure that even where you think you might win, like in a Wisconsin, Michigan, here in Pennsylvania, that you need to run through the finish line and have your eye on it and not give an inch of room for anybody to move up. But I do think that she also, during that time, was able to deal with him well and not use the nicknames and get into the gutter. No, I know. Hey, I hear you. I mean, you know, but what I'm saying is we should not be, I think that we're inflating his prowess more than we should, and that I get scared, I get concerned sometimes that we're getting scared of him as though he's something that he's not. He's not, you know. He's not invincible. He's not this grand maestro of politics. He's not.
Well, I think that might be a good place to wrap up our conversation. Please join me in thanking Secretary Castro for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to all of you for being here, and the book signing will be upstairs in just a few minutes. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.